I'm really glad that I followed off after all of these other folks, because I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on the specific design criteria, the levels. That I think it was excellent, the work that was done, the presentations, and there's an enormous number of opportunities for people to obtain that information, and different design criteria that have been developed, and good research on all of that, both in the academic field and the industry, that you'll find quite a bit of that. My background is I started doing being involved in stormwater primarily management before people knew what stormwater was. I've been a consultant for 30 years. I started out as a contractor actually building some of these things, but people didn't know what they were building. They had no clue. They didn't even know why, and it was a kind of a big deal then when people started actually making the ground go like this instead of like this for all their landscaping, and it was why are you doing that? It's going to hold the water. My background, again, is I'm a certified professional soil scientist, certified erosion and sediment control professional. I've been in that program since the 80s, and have actually a pretty low number in that group. And I'm a qualified stormwater designer in California. They have their own program and inspector. I'm not going to go into all of the regulations, but the original stormwater regulations are 3,500 years old. They're embodied in Hammurabi's code, that if you're too lazy to manage your stormwater or your dams or your water that you're maintaining on your site, then you'll be liable, and you and your family and your property will be sold off in order to pay for the damage that occurs on somebody else's property. Today's regulations don't sell off people's families in order to pay for those for violations, but the penalties are pretty stiff, just not quite that stiff. So why is it a problem? That's a big thing. There's environmental issues, there's economic issues, and there's legal issues. The environmental issue is really simple. We talk about all these other things, but a tenth of an inch of soil or runoff that comes off of a construction site or that's dragged in from developed areas equals 20 tons, 15 tons of sediment, 15 to 20 pounds of phosphorus, 7,500 pounds of algal biomass. If you like to fish, that's a real easy thing to understand. And that's my goal, is to try and make it understandable and make it right there in people's faces why this is important. The other is the punishing regulatory fines, and not just fines. It's not just the regulators. It's people. People can come after you. The people have the right to say, you've damaged my property, you've damaged our property, you've damaged our environment, and it has caused a lot of problems. And really, when it comes down to the underlying process of all stormwater regulation for treatment and uncontrolled, is it's trespassing. If I let property, and this goes back to Hammurabi's code, if I let uncontrolled and untreated stormwater off my site causes problems to somebody else, I'm trespassing on the public, or I'm trespassing on somebody's property. And that's how it's essentially prosecuted. The historical focus has always been on quantity. How can we get it down the hill, into that stream, and down as quickly as possible, and get it off of my site? And so you just make bigger pipes, bigger and bigger pipes. You get it out of being my problem. And you still see that in a lot of urban areas. What are most of the designed systems are great big concrete line channels, great big underground pipes, and they're still there, and they're still going to be there, because we we're backing our way into, still to this day, we're still backing our way into what's called controlling the issues at, not at the end of the pipe, but before it gets into the pipe. And that's what we're all talking about. Not letting it get into the pipe, not letting all of the runoff, not letting the carriers that are going with it. You have the runoff spikes managed by bigger pipes. Of course, it just accelerates the problem at the end of the pipe, and it really goes by solution to pollution is dilution. Part of we talk about all these treatment methods and holding this, but if you just start looking at it from the standpoint, if you have a small amount of runoff from anything, whether it be urban areas or new development or construction sites or whatever, if you double the velocity, the reason that you control it at the point of at the beginning, if you double the velocity, you quadruple the energy. Quadrupling the energy creates a 64 times this particle size that can be moved. So when you double the velocity of runoff, you take something that's the pebble and you turn it into a fist. And that's what now is scouring and chewing up. And a lot of issues come from that process rather than the initial start. This particular is an example of that. It started out as a little thing, top of a ski area, and then it gets into the roadside. And you look at this picture right here. Somebody earlier on was talking about the difference of different kinds of erosion control products. And I'm going to talk erosion, I'm going to talk about stormwater and infiltration, but I'm kind of bringing all these things into part of the whole thing, because it's a matter of controlling the volume and the velocity and the products that it's carrying. This particular disaster was created by straw bales. Control, a best management practice control, was caused this major disaster. Why? Because straw bales were placed in, they were never maintained, they were never followed up, and I'm going to talk a lot about straw bales later. But this resulted in the straw bales moving down, plugging up pipes, and it just cascaded down the mountain until it resulted in this. So our change in philosophy has been to water quality, detention, retention, and reuse. And there's differences there. Detention, you're holding it for a long period of time and maybe getting treatment. You get retention for a period of time and expecting it to leave. And then the reuse. How do we take that water and reuse it? And that's been the biggest challenge, is how do we reuse water? How do we get it back into the ground so it recharges without poisoning our groundwater? Treatment and removal of contaminants is the utmost key here. And managing the source instead of the symptom. We see the end result of our polluted, eutrophicated lakes or streams that have been poisoned. But how do we manage it at the source, which is the best and most efficient means to manage it? And there's all these different parameters. You got the physical, chemical, biologic. Then you actually have the hydrologic. And people oftentimes don't think of that volume and velocity as a actual pollutant. But there's a reason for we retain and hold back water. It's not just for the treatment, but it's also to keep it from scouring further downstream. And then oftentimes, again, we don't think of the temperature as a physical pollutant, but it is. And there's a reason why we want to make sure that we're paying attention. So all these factors tie in together. The biggest thing about it is the soil. How do we maintain the soil? And I thought it was an excellent point. Was the key to it is we can engineer anything, but if we don't have the right soil, or we're not paying attention to the soil and what is going to be the end recipient of all of this infiltration and runoff, then we're missing the boat. We're going to not be able to design this correctly. And there are all kinds of things. You know, you can have what are the infiltration rates? And I, again, there was great information there, and you can come up and, you know, develop your expected infiltration rates and all of the things that go along with that, the, you know, texture class and infiltration rates, and they're all great. It's very important, and that's very important at the design part. But the problem is that what happens when we install these things? The bulldozers are going all over it, the tracked vehicles, the wheeled vehicles. All of a sudden, your infiltration rate is 2 to 10 times less than what's expected, because they've been all, the soil has been completely altered. It's been completely compacted. And at the beginning of it, you may know the different soils are going to compact at different rates. Different soils are going to react to compaction in different manners. And there's actual best management practices. Everybody thinks of a best management practice. I mean, people really have mistaken it as a BMT. They call it a best management thing. Like, I'm going to go set something out there, and that's going to be the answer. Practice is practice. The practice, the best management practice is not doing. The best management practice is not getting in there and destroying what you already have. I can't tell you how many times I've gone into places where they had a fantastic vegetation, spirea, and a, you know, just a quasi wetland fringe type of environment. Wiped it all out, swept it all clean, brought the landscapers in, and spent $18,000 planting spirea, not the variety that grows in that particular area. So that's something to know up front. And from my experience as a contractor, having done this, I've watched these things fail and why they fail. And, of course, having the background in soils really helped me be able to do that. We have, unfortunately, too many site assumptions. Too often people are looking at it and they say, the soil. They have no clue what the soil is. It's just soil. It's below that ground. It's below the plants, so it must be soil. What kind of soil are we dealing with? Are we going to deal, you know, are you building on that soil? Are you going to utilize that soil? Are we going to scrape it off, set it off to the side, bring it back, put it back? How are we going to use that? So bad site assumptions, bad construction practices, what I talked about here. And then you have to understand the physical, biological setting as well. You take a site from one side to the other, and you look at what happened. What happens when you take one vegetative condition, strip it off, tear it up, drive all over it, and then say, okay, now what kind of hydrologic condition are we going to have next? Here we are with a standard of the industry, something that you'll see everywhere. I have built, I've designed, I've installed, I've watched, I've monitored a million of these things. Grassy infiltration swales, grassy infiltration basins. You see them everywhere. And to a certain extent, they have been very successful. They're not always, you know, we've seen a tremendous number of really excellent examples of other alternatives, engineered systems. But really when it comes down to, and we do have to get to the reality of the cost. And the cost is that these are probably, for the price, quickest and easiest. And if they're constructed right, they're very, very effective. They're not very effective if you dump them full of fertilizer and decide to turn them, make them into your lawn. But they are very effective in a wide variety of applications and uses. And then you have the what you call the transport swale, where you do get some treatment. You get some processes going on, you do get some infiltration if it's constructed right, and it connects up to other larger storage basins like such as this. And it's really important to make sure that your when these are built, that the inlet to them runs in. But you know, again, we go back to this where reality meets the design. The designer said, yeah, we want this thing and we want to have this riser pipe and it's going to be about 1 foot, 18 inches or whatever, and the contractor actually puts it in right at the bottom of the basin. So what's happening here? The water runs in basin, down into the pipe, and out into the storm sewer system. So you've gotten very little treatment. In fact, in some cases where they've actually maintained, they've cut and fertilized these things to keep them green because they're outside their business, you've actually increased the total nitrogen and total phosphorus load into the stormwater system. Again, just examples of this, you know, the swales that are very useful and have been very successful. You have stormwater wetlands or basins that turn into wetlands. Again, really a very successful process, but you also have to keep in mind that in a lot of conditions, this isn't it's good for finishing, but they're a real tough thing to manage because you don't want open water for an extended period of time because now you're going to have mosquitoes. You're going to have all kinds of vectors that are going to be part of that. You also can turn a situation into where it starts stinking after a while, and so now you don't really like that either. So it's extremely important to make sure that the management, that the design is one thing, but then somebody's going to have to manage. And this is where I'm going to really talk about where is the management at the time of installation. How many people can you name that design these systems that actually go out in the field at the beginning to make sure that the contractor has read this and understands it while it's being constructed so they can check and see as-builts or demand to see as-built photographs as it's being built? So that was a really good point about, boy, these pictures look really cool. They're great. They look exactly how you want it to go, but that's not how it happens. The dump truck comes out there. They dump it out on the parking lot. They shove it into the hole. They smear it out with a cat, and they got out there, and they smash some gravel down on top of that, and then they drive in, and they put a little layer of filter fabric on that, and then they put their sandy loam soil on that, And does it really look like that picture? No, it looks more like those big swales, and that's what you're going to end up with. And then you have these swimming pools that are kind of like halfway between a wetland, a basin, a holding basin, and obviously a highly dangerous spot where they had to put fences around it because they're afraid people are going to fall into it. But it's dry. You have stormwater storage, these areas where the gardens, the rain, natural basin systems, and you know, I'm really all for it. I think that really is the answer. But now we get back to where a lot of this discussion, and it's a great discussion about vegetation. Which vegetation are you choosing, and who's choosing that vegetation? Who's making the decision on what vegetation needs to go in there? Do you have that on board? Or do we just turn them into landscaping? Because that's really what a lot of these things end up being. You know, what good does it really do if we just, you know, yeah, we have a basin, we have some plants, and you can see the inlet is down on the bottom, so, you know, you get some dribbling through the bark. Well, where's the bark from? Who specified that bark? Who came up with that? Where did that, you know, does it have things in it? Was it treated bark? Is it treated to not, is it treated with pesticides or with herbicides in order to not grow weeds? Because they have that. And again, what it turns out to be to a great extent a lot of times is just landscaping. And they're not bad systems. I mean, they're kind of a little odd. They need to grow, and as they fill in, maybe they'll be. But you know, for the most part, they're being developed primarily for that pretty look. And then you have this kind of thing. This again, designed with some odd function. Why you would put a curb on the edge of your basin? And then the basin is so deep that this is what I would call, and I do call, is the this is the lottery for the person that likes to sue municipalities. One, what an easy thing to trip into and pretend that you've hurt, or truly fall into and truly be hurt. So why would you put something like this with little notches so some of the water can get in, or it has to run along your sidewalk and then it can go in? Or I have seen more and more of these, and it's becoming, I still can't figure out where that design concept is coming from. Really deep swales that are dangerous to step into or break your ankle. You don't want them to step in those deep, so we'll put a little 4-inch curb so now they can trip into them. Again, same thing, just showing, you know, where they are, pedestrian sidewalks. And then there's the, let's gravel the whole bottom because we really only want the plants to grow. We don't want anything else to grow in there, so let's fill it up with gravel and then plant the plants through into that lower material. So again, you won't have any water standing, and it's a little less dangerous because you can just twist your ankle going into that instead of break your ankle. So the important thing is the site evaluation and selection. That's clear. We need more soils information. We need site-specific soils information. It's not good enough to go and open up the soil survey or go on the web and find the soil of that area, because you know you're picking a soil that's a 5-acre map unit and you're trying to apply it to a site-specific location. What are the treatment systems? What's the soil contact time during infiltration? We need to have soil contact time. Who's inspecting and certifying the system? How do we document the compliance? Because a good question that came up before is, how do you know whether it's working or not? Who's going to document the compliance? Well, you can document it. There's soil sampling. You can build that into your system as well. You can sample water that as it's coming out. You can also sample the soil, what kind of activity is going on. They do that in land application of sewer systems. You go out there and you sample the soil at different layers. How far is it penetrating and what's the accumulation? So you need to do good information, get good information for your site evaluation selection. You need a treatment time that has soil contact time so you don't have too slow, so you just run off or too fast so you have groundwater contamination. You're planning for it. What's the plan of how we do it? We plan for the average. What is the definition of average? Statistically, the average is that if I stand with 1 foot in a bucket of boiling water and I stand with my other foot in a bucket of freezing water, my average body temperature is normal. And that's the average. And it does you no good at all. It has zero value in most cases for the actual design. What you need to be doing is taking a close look. You look at that line right there. That the average is the green line at the bottom. I'm going to design for that. The extreme conditions, and in fact, in my particular part of the world, the Pacific Northwest, we have what's called the dry season and the wet season. Well, you have different best management practices for the dry season, different best management practices for the wet season. But 2 years out of 10, and the wet season, of course, is the winter time. Dry season is the summertime, and you can go from May until October. It's dry. And so that's what a lot of designs do. However, 2 years out of 10, the second wettest month of the year is June, just because. It's just an anomaly that occurs. And we have some of the largest spikes in rainfall happen in those periods of time, in those early summer periods of time. So it's really important. You can't design everything for the 100-year flood, obviously. You can't design things for every extreme. But designing just for the average runoff is designing to fail. Inspection and certification, if the work gets done, the system will probably work. The design is not a problem. There's a lot of good designs out there, but how do we document the compliance? Who's doing that documented compliance? It's incredibly important that somebody is doing it. And not somebody so that the designer can point the finger at the inspector and the inspector points the finger at the designer and says, your design is no good. There's got to be a mesh there, that there's a responsibility by the designer to actually check these things. It's not good enough just to say, you know, this is what I did, and if you did it, because if you did it right, it would work. Because in a lot of cases, the end product comparison, your as-built, you come back and you go, that didn't work all that well. All these systems have developed over what didn't work. My work is all based on what didn't work. I've learned from that and make sure they work. It's not good enough to do the right thing. We have to document we're in compliance. And because with the best plans and planning, nature will always go and side with that hidden flaw. Line this channel with rock, and this water decides to run next to the channel. Put in the right pipe, and something will happen to plug that pipe. Tell the contractor he's got to put straw bales to protect the inlet of this pipe, and he'll put two straw bales at the top of the pipe and say, that's good, did it. I'm done. You didn't specify and tell me what I needed to do. And this is the worst case. I'm going to talk about straw bales. This is the worst case. Straw bales have no use on any erosion control project other than to be broken up and spread on the ground. They have no use. I have watched more damage and more destruction occur because once the straw bale's in the ground, it never comes out. Because I challenge anybody in this room to get a straw bale that's nice and light, pop it in the ground, and 3, 4, 5 months later, if it's rained on it and the sediment's in it, and that 500-pound straw bale now has to be taken out of the ground and moved somewhere, it's not going to. And the contractor's not going to move it. Or if he does move it, he's got to move it with an excavator. So what is he going to do? He's going to go down in there, dig it out, and now you've got the same damage that occurred from the beginning. So straw bales are dangerous. And then, again, watching through the inspection, making sure things get installed correctly, make sure it gets done right. And this last one, this one right here, is an example of watching what gets done. Because this was a plan that had little dashed lines where the straw bales were supposed to be. And it got put in exactly the way it's supposed to. Monitoring and restoration, all systems fail in increments. We need to be able to identify when that happens and specify a means for restoration. With that, I'm just going to show you a couple of good systems that were designed correctly so you get the water in them. And then systems like this where the soil was completely ignored, the soil of that particular area was completely ignored. It started out as a grassline basin and turned into a gravel basin that just turned into a big pool. So if you know the soil, you know the site, don't assume. You need to know specifically what you're dealing with. And that's the end of the pipe.
Great. Thank you.